Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, Cameroon has seen increased violence in ongoing civil war based on its linguistic sectarian divide. Can the nation survive? How much is this a democracy deficiency? And how much is a failure of leadership? In this hour, Doug Becker explores how can Cameroon overcome its governance challenges.
I'm Doug Becker. On today's show, we return to the troubled nation of Cameroon. Creating a state does not create national identity or a government that can represent all sectarian groups within that country. Most African nations emerged out of European colonies created without regard to local history, identities, and culture. But Cameroon is rare in that it was born out of two different colonies, the French Cameroon and British Cameroon. The nation has two official languages and two distinctly different sectarian identities. French Cameroonians have dominated post-independent politics and have marginalized the Anglophone community. This has compelled resistance within the region, leading to conflict and war. In 2016, Anglophone Cameroonians reacted to government violent responses to protests with a guerrilla campaign in what is now known as the Ambazonia War or the Cameroonian Civil War. Ambazonia declares independence, and the government sends in its military to suppress this campaign in the Northwest region and Southwest region, which is collectively known as Southern Cameroons. Thousands have died. And UNICEF has estimated that as many as 1.3 million people are in need of humanitarian assistance. On today's show, we will explore the challenges of integration, of the structures of governance, and the need for democratization to confront Cameroon's political threats, violence, and war. Our panel is John Makum Mbaku. He's the Brady Presidential Distinguished Professor of Economics and John S. Hinckley Fellow at Weber State University. He's the author of Protecting Minority Rights in African Countries, a Constitutional Political Economy Approach, and co-author of Corruption in Africa, Causes, Consequences, and Cleanups. And Moses K. Tessie, Professor of Political Science at Middle Tennessee State University. He's the author of Balancing Sovereignty and Development in International Affairs, Cameroon's Post-Independence Relations with France, Africa, and the World, and a contributor in State, Politics, and the Struggle for Democracy in Cameroon. Thank you both very much for joining us. John Mbaku, first, what is the current status, the political status and the status of conflict in Cameroon today?
Well, thank you for inviting me to participate in this important discussion. What is currently going on in Cameroon is that the country has degenerated into a sort of a civil war, in that the central government has sent troops to the two Anglophone regions, the Northwest region and the Southwest region. And the idea of sending troops there was to maintain peace and allow schools to open so children could go to school, so commerce could continue to take place. But what Anglophones say is that the troops didn't come there to do so because the people of the Anglophone regions never had any problems with children going to school or them not being able to engage in commerce. That the problem started when Anglophones, mostly lawyers and school teachers, who were then followed by parents, went on the streets to protest against what they believe was the central government's slow but steady efforts to get rid of Anglophone institutions and replace them by French institutions. And the lawyers were basically arguing that the government was trying to change the adjudication of cases in Anglophone courts, change the language of adjudication to French, and then force them to use French civil law as the basis for the practice of law in the Anglophone regions instead of the common law that they inherited from the British and English, which they inherited from the British. teachers, on the other hand, were protesting that while they appreciated the central government's effort to send Francophones or French-speaking teachers to teach French in Anglophone schools, while they appreciated that, Anglophone teachers said they did not appreciate the fact that the government was also sending teachers who could not speak English to teach subjects other than French. For example, the government was sending teachers to teach biology, chemistry in schools, and the Anglophone teachers were complaining that as a result of that process, many of the students were no longer able to pass the exams that they needed to pass in order to graduate from high school and then proceed to universities. So all these problems caused the Anglophones to go on the streets and protest. But what happened was that instead of trying to negotiate or get into some kind of dialogue with the Anglophone protesters, the government sent security forces that went in there and brutally tried to suppress the demonstration, the peaceful demonstrations, ended up killing a lot of people, burning a lot of villages, and destroying the economic capacity of the region completely, and forcing a lot of villagers to run into the forest to live there, creating a humanitarian situation in which thousands of Cameroonians have either fled into the forest to live there or are now living in neighboring countries, primarily Nigeria and Equatorial Guinea, because they are no longer willing to stay at home and be subjected to government oppression. Now, what happened was that the brutality with which the government responded to the peaceful confrontation gave a group of Cameroonians who traditionally, since the early 1970s, had been arguing in favor of secession, but had not had much of an audience. This brutal response gave those individuals who called themselves Ambazonians or separatists. Remember, these separatists had been around for quite a while. They were not satisfied with the way the Anglophone regions were being treated by the Francophone-dominated central government in Yaoundé. Many of them had been agitating for secession, but the secession movement had not yet really gained very much ground within the Anglophone society. But this brutal suppression of Anglophone protests in 2016-2017 gave those individuals an opportunity to basically go out and declare independence and ask for the formation of an Anglophone, an independent Southern Cameroons, the name that the two Anglophone regions had before unification in 1961. So what we have now is the struggle between the central government and the Anglophone regions. And that struggle within the Anglophone regions is also divided into individuals who want the government to return to the federation, the 1961 federation, and groups that no longer want the federation, but want complete independence. And so that's where we are at the moment.
And Moses Tessy, Cameroon at this point, having kind of devolved into conflict, this is certainly, it's been described as having a democracy deficit. First, would greater democracy lead to a better integration of the country, potentially resolving this conflict? Or what would be the most effective ways to try to resolve this conflict peacefully?
I do think that the greater democracy would really help. But greater democracy without really dealing with the core issues that have raised this problem would not help. And the core issue being that of the Anglophone Cameroonian identity associated with the British legacy, that is the English language, the English educational system, and the common law judiciary system. I think those are really key. The Anglophone Cameroonians who are especially the students and the lawyers, they were driven by those particular issues. Now, you can have greater democratization that would still continue along the lines of the British educational system and the judicial system also being marginalized. So I think the way to look at it is a greater democratization that also leads to certain institutional changes. In this case, probably the framework of the Cameroonian political system to bring about some type of a federal system. Now, whatever form that federal system will take is subject to discussion. But such a federal system should then allow each of the federated states certain autonomy in certain areas. In that case, therefore, the current two Anglophone regions would then really be governed in accordance with the English legal system, the use of the English language, and other so-called Anglo-Saxon institutions. Now, in terms of the form of federation, I think that is an issue in itself, because while the group that are now fighting for secession are calling for a return to a two-state federation as it was prior to the declaration of the unitary state in 1972, there are also other regions in the country. Now, there are people who are calling for a federation based on the 10 regions that exist today. Now, some have come up with other formulas, such as four-state type federation and so forth. So the point I'm trying to make is that the Anglophone problem is a very important problem in the country. But there's another problem associated with other regions who also feel marginalized, but not marginalized on the basis of their colonial tradition, but rather marginalized in the way in which the state has been going about in its governance and so forth. And at the same time, along those lines, the Anglophone regions would also raise other issues related to economic development and other resource distribution. But for the time being, the genesis of this problem really came as a result of this issue of dual colonial identity that really moved on to the post-colonial era.
And John, this federal system makes me think of one of the challenges that African states have typically faced about how strong the central government can be to create some degree of strength as a way to promote economic development and as a way to try to combat against separatist regions or external influences versus a strong central state that just raises the stakes of who controls the presidency. And so is this kind of an inherent tension? I guess the big question, how do you resolve this question of the need for strength in the central state without it becoming so strong it becomes a tool of oppression?
One thing that we have to make clear here is that the most effective way to construct a country, especially a country that composes of several, what you might call factions that cannot be separated because they are based on ethnicity, is to first acknowledge that those factions exist. When you go back and think of what James Madison and Hamilton and his co-founders were trying to do in the 1700s, they were aware of the fact that faction or partisanship would be a serious problem to the Republic. That's why they chose the Republican. They did not want democratic system in the US or democracy. They chose a Republican system of government. And the idea was to acknowledge the fact that direct election, for example, of politicians, would create a situation in which a demagogue working with a faction could end up dominating the government and oppressing other groups, either the minority or the majority. And so one of the problems that African countries failed to understand at the time of independence was that they were coming up with a situation in which they were going to be dealing with a lot of factions. Factions that had their own ideas about government. Factions that had their own ideas about economics. and so on and so on. One of the things that they should have done at that time was to sit down and actually engage in a very long period of discussion like the South Africans did in their post-apartheid government. Sit down and literally, I would say, bring everybody to a big stadium and say, okay, there are 50, 60 ethnic groups in this country that were brought together through colonialism. It's a marriage of convenience. None of us consented to this marriage, but here we are. Let us agree that this country belongs to us. And then the next step would be, how are we going to relate to each other and form a government that would allow us to be able to engage in self-actualization without impeding the ability of other groups from doing the same thing? You see, this conversation was never taken in most African countries. And of course, in Cameroon, it wasn't, because the first part of Cameroon that got independence was the French part. And that French part was the first to accept General de Gaulle's constitution. So General de Gaulle offered this constitution, the 1958 constitution, to its former colonies in Africa. Cameroon was the first to accept that constitution. That is why if you look at Cameroon's constitution, even till today, despite all the amendments, it looks very similar to the French constitution of October 4, 1958. And the question you would ask yourself, why would Cameroon adapt a French constitutional model, given the fact that that constitution, the 1958 constitution, was developed in view of the political problems that the French were having at the time, the Algerian War and all those things, just coming out of World War II. Those conditions did not exist in Cameroon. France had a very good history of democracy, dating back many, many, many years. Cameroon didn't. And so the question was, why was Cameroon adopting this constitution without any paying any attention to the problems that existed within the country? And so what you have in Cameroon now is that you have a so-called federation or so-called system in which the central government, we call it an imperial presidency. The central government is very powerful. It makes decisions on virtually everything. And so the regions and the people have no opportunity to have input into what happens in the country. And so this is one of the reasons why it becomes very difficult to solve a problem, because whenever there's a problem in any part of the country, people look up to the central government to make the decision. And most of the time, the central government will make a decision that is not appropriate for the situation or that does not resolve the situation. For example, as Professor Tesi was saying, if you look at the 1961 constitution, that is the constitution that brought the two, the French and the English speaking parts together. The government did not deal with issues that were very critical to the Anglophone identity. Issues of language, the educational system, infrastructure, the common law. Those issues, if you read that constitution, they are not even mentioned. In fact, the only thing that is mentioned is in the 1961 constitution is that English and French would be the official languages, but, and this is what made Anglophones very angry, but French documents would be legal and English translations would not be considered legal. You see, if the government, if the country had gotten engaged in the type of constitution making that a country is supposed to do, those issues would have been resolved at that time. Issues of language, issues of identity, and so on and so on. So it would have not been possible for the government later on to change the system and erode, destroy the Anglophone identity the way the government has been able to do. Because everything Paul Biya has done, everything Ahidjo did, they claim that what they did was constitutional. And in a way it was. And part of the problem has to do with the fact that those issues were never dealt with. So moving on forward, the only way you can solve that problem in Cameroon is for Cameroonians to sit down and talk about all these issues and decide by themselves how they want to relate to each other. And I've said this at different forums, that if Anglophones end up saying they don't want to live with the Francophones anymore, I don't see any reason why they should be forced to do so. And if they decide that they want to live with the Francophones, then they should be given an opportunity to decide how that relationship is going to be.
You're listening to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. We are discussing the ongoing political and military crisis in Cameroon with John Mukim Mbaku of Weber State University and Moses K. Tessie of Middle Tennessee State University. Professor Tessie, that actually raises a really interesting point about whether Cameroon, as it's currently constructed, A, does it work? And B, if it doesn't, what needs to be done to make it work? Do the separatists have a point? And I know there had been a normative prohibition on redrawing African maps post-colonial in the early days of decolonization. It's a lot of new African states and a lot of new proposed African states. Should Cameroon be one of those?
Well, the thing is, it's a lot more complicated. Before maybe I get to that, let me just more or less mention something relating to what Professor Mbaku said in terms of when the Cameroonian state, especially the writing of the constitution that eventually became Cameroon's constitution, really, the constitution of the Republic of Cameroon was written after it gained independence. It would really be giving France a lot of credit, but it was written after it gained independence. And you can imagine what happens when the person who, after a violent and bitter nationalist struggle, ends up being propelled to power as president without a constitution, and therefore have to write the constitution himself. You can imagine the type of constitution that is going to come out of that. Basically, they used the French model in crafting the constitution that he wrote in 1960. And I mention this because it was a really very big debate and discussion, because in fact, by the end of 1961, when the when the Southern Cameroon, that is the English-speaking section of the current country, really joined already independent Republic of Cameroon. By that time, by the end of 1961, the Republic of Cameroon was already a one-party system. It was a one-party system based on the use of a whole range of different tactics in really in intimidating and then also co-opting and then forcibly bringing the opposition to the government party itself through imprisonment and all those type of things. Now, that's very important because you had really serious opposition by the nationalists who were fighting that, basically trying to prevent the president who had really been given power by the French from really crafting the type of constitution that ended up being crafted. Now, in terms of what can be done or whether there is any thing that can really be done to try to maybe deal with the fault lines that already exist in the country. Well, first and foremost, any state, at least most states, but in fact, I could even make the generalization that any state, when there is a segment that seeks to secede or separate, there are few, if at all there are any, that have not used whatever means possible to try to prevent them from seceding. Now, while you cannot really, force a group to remain within a state, and then they will do so and operate legitimately as if nothing really happened, it's really very difficult. And so the thing, though, is the very first error that Biya did when this occurrence started was that he didn't do anything. He just sat there. He did not really go to either the Northwest or the Southwest region and then give a speech and try to really calm the population down and then lay down some of the type of things that would address the issues that they raised. And as Professor Mbaku has mentioned. Indeed, the protesters, whether the lawyers or the students and the teachers, they were protesting the policies or the situations they were under. The small segment, small group of people who hijacked the peaceful demonstrations and then used it now to further the agenda that they had, which was separation. And so a strong central government is not really going to take it, because this issue, I mean, the Anglophone situation is really different, but you have similar calls for federation, calls for federation. The northern elites, they've really made their own calls, you know, for federation. In the Western region, they've also making calls for federation. In fact, even in the littoral, which is one of the regions which is even much closer to the southwest region of Cameroon, that is the southwest Anglophone region of Cameroon, they're not very comfortable with the state of politics in the country today. So I think, the way I look at it is that I think if the government had been really serious, the so-called national conference that they convened, they should have really convened a more serious and independent type national conference and then use it to save face and come up with some genuine proposals instead of micromanaging and controlling the situation the way they did. And so the only thing I think that is going to really help significantly is that if they were to pour a lot of what I would call reconstruction funds and be able to succeed in implementing the reconstruction of the Southwest and the Northwest region, and then open up the system much more seriously for genuine democratic participation, elections, and so forth, then it might calm down the situation while they begin to think of some more lasting institutional mechanisms.
Professor Mbaku, I know that the president, that Paul Biya, first of all, he's been in office for an awfully long time. And so just in general, the need for new leadership is something that is endemic in Cameroon, endemic in a number of African states. And he's been criticized for not taking this issue more seriously, this need for reform, you know, more seriously. How much of this is really just a crisis of leadership as well, that if new leadership could address these issues, how much of this is much more structural? And I know in some ways the two are linked, the need for leadership to kind of change some of the structures, but how much of this is really at the feet of the president?
It is true that leadership is very important. There's no question about it, because if we had had, if Biya had been a better leader, we may not have descended into civil war the way things are in Cameroon. We would still have had problems, but not to the extent that we have them at the moment. So leadership is important. The problem there is that leadership is necessary, but it's not sufficient. And that has to do with the fact that the problems you have in Cameroon are more structural than just a matter of leadership itself. We have poor institutions. We have institutions that were designed to fail. Institutions that were designed to support a dictatorship, not a democracy. So the institutions that you have in Cameroon today, even if you change leadership, and this is something that Cameroonians need to understand, and I've emphasized this over and over. When Ahidjo was in power, Cameroonians were very dissatisfied, including Anglophone Cameroonians. And so many of them, when Paul Biya took over in 1982, many of them actually went on the streets and were celebrating, because Paul Biya came into power and made a very strong speech telling people that he was going to have a new government full of rigor and full of a situation in which citizens would be able to criticize the government, citizens would be able to participate in government, citizens would be allowed to make decisions for themselves, and that he was going to decentralize the government and allow local communities to have greater impact on public policy. And he also went on to argue that he was going to reinvigorate the traditional leaders, the traditional system of leadership, the chiefs and the fons, and give them an opportunity to participate in government. So many people all over the country were celebrating this new view of government. And he also mentioned the fact that he was going to change the law regulating media to allow newspapers to publish at will and be able to contribute to development. But you see, that euphoria suddenly turned into something completely different, because within a very short period of time, when Cameroonians started exercising that power that they thought had been was being given to them by the government, Paul Biya started becoming very oppressive, to the point where within a very short period of time, people started wishing that Ahidjo were back to power and arguing that Paul Biya was actually more oppressive than Ahidjo. And he has been very, very oppressive. And so one of the problems here is that as much as we think that Paul Biya is an incompetent leader, he's not a very good leader, one thing that we have to keep in mind is that even if Paul Biya were not in power, the problems wouldn't go away, because Cameroon does not have good institutions. Cameroon does not have a good political structure, because Paul Biya is not the only one in Cameroon who is perpetuating all these problems. His ministers are doing the same thing. There's a very high level of corruption among his ministers. District officers, even all the way to the very little level, are engaging in very oppressive policies. I can give you an example. The chief of my village passed away a couple of years ago. And according to the tradition in our village, when the chief passed away, the council of elders, those are the chief, the kingmakers, they will come up and announce to the village. They don't say he has died. They will say the chief has gone missing. And when a new chief is crowned, then they say the chief has been found. So when the chief of my village died, the council of elders got together. And based on what they had discussed with the chief before he died, they crowned a new chief. And a district officer who was over the area, district officer over that area, who comes from a completely different ethnic group. In fact, my village is in the Northwest. The district officers comes from the Southwest, doesn't know anything about the traditions. But simply because the person who was chosen as the chief based on our traditions was not a member and refused to become a member of the ruling party, the CBDM, that district officer issued a decree closing down the chief's palace, having that chief, the new chief, arrested, and imposing a new chief on the community. You see, this gives you an example of how dysfunctional the institutions in the country are. So yes, many people have argued, and they continue to argue, that Biya is the problem because he's been in power since 1982. Yes, he is part of the problem, but he's not the biggest part of the problem. If you put in a new person today, that person, just like Madison argued when he said, if men were angels, okay? But men are not angels. And so Madison's argument was that because men are not angels, we should not trust men. We should trust institutions. We should put our faith in institutions and try to find a way to put into our institutions mechanisms to constrain men from becoming dictators, from becoming individuals who are imposing tyranny on the rest of the population. This is something that Cameroonians just basically do not seem to appreciate, do not seem to understand, is that getting rid of Biya is not going to solve the problem. Because as soon as you put the next guy in, just like we did with Ahidjo was out, Biya came in, and we continue to have the same problem. So this process of state reconstruction that would allow Cameroonians to come up with institutions that can make it possible for them to be able to hold our leaders accountable and prevent them from engaging in the type of activities that people like Biya and his associates are engaging in. This is the critical point. Regardless of whether the country stays together or splits, without institutions, you'll continue to have the same problem.
Let that be the last word, the importance of building institutions and hopefully using this conflict as a means by which to create a more governable, more democratic, more integrated state in Cameroon. Our panel today has been John Makum Mbaku, the Brady Presidential Distinguished Professor of Economics and John S. Hinckley Fellow at Weber State University. He's the author of Protecting Minority Rights in African Countries, a Constitutional Political Economy Approach, and co-author of Corruption in Africa, Causes, Consequences, and Cleanups. And Moses K. Tessie, Professor of Political Science at Middle Tennessee University. He's the author of Balancing Sovereignty and Development in International Affairs, Cameroon's Post-Independence Relations with France, Africa, and the World, and a contributor to The State, Politics, and the Struggle for Democracy in Cameroon. Thank you both very much for your insights. And we'd like to thank Debbie McCormick for her work helping us produce today's show.
When we come back, how Cameroon can overcome its challenges. Stay with us. This is the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. As civil war in Cameroon continues with clashes between the Francophone and Anglophone populations, protests against the violations of federalism agreements were met with state-led violence. What are the impacts? We'll hear from one of the organizers.
I'm Doug Becker. In response to allegations of government infringement on the rights and the federalist system within Cameroon, activists in Anglophone Cameroon, in what's known as Southern Cameroons, have organized peaceful resistance campaigns. These peaceful resistance campaigns have been met with violence, and many of the leaders have been targeted for arrest and imprisonment. One of those leaders is our guest, Dr. Fantem E. Neba. He was Secretary General of the Teachers Trade Union of the University of Buea before his arrest on the 17th of January, 2017. He was the Secretary General of the now banned Cameroon Anglophone Civil Society Consortium. And now he is in exile and serves as the Secretary General of the Southern Cameroons Alliance. He was also a professor of applied linguistics at the University of Buea, Cameroon, and the author of English Language Mastery and Academic Success. So Dr. Neba, thank you very much for joining us. First, you had organized for Anglophones in Cameroon advocating for human rights and political representation. What had motivated that organization?
Thanks for having me. At the time when we engaged the government, we had lived with us. We came into Cameroon in 1961 after a plebiscite, which required us to either join to independence by joining Cameroon or get our independence by joining the Federal Republic of Nigeria. We chose to join Cameroon and become a federated country. So we were actually the Federal Republic of Cameroon, and we had a federal constitution which was not supposed to be touched. But unfortunately, we did not have a union treaty. So over time, the government of Cameroon abolished the federal system and created a United Republic. And with time, they abolished the United Republic and returned to a monolithic political system where our people lost their identity. Over the years, they began to absorb us, began to marginalize us, and pushed our people into poverty, misery, and deprivation. So at a certain point, we realized that even our educational system, our legal system was being eroded. Our children did not have jobs after college. Our children were motorbike riders and they did all kinds of menial jobs. And so we, as teachers and university professors, we came together and we said, no, we cannot be training our children and not seeing the fruit of our labor. So we engaged the government and said, there is a need to restore our cultural identity. First of all, our system needs to be revivified. Our children need to have jobs within our system, because we realized that Francophones were coming, Cameroon, were coming into our own territory, getting our jobs, teaching in our schools, and some of the teachers were teaching in a language that was not English. And so even admissions into medical schools, schools of engineering, in our own universities, our children were in the minority. And so we told the government to redress it. When we started the protest, the government ignored us because we wrote to the government for several years and the government did not respond. And so we decided to declare an indefinite protest and ask all the parents to keep the children at home. And since Francophones, citizens of French Cameroon, had started sending their children into our own educational system, they were bound to be affected because there were no schools. And so they now had to address the issue. When they came to address the issue, we realized that they were not willing to get to the root of the matter, because corruption had been so entrenched that admissions into our own school were being sold for as much as $6,000 to read medicine, to read engineering, and the money was collected at the ministry under the control of the Minister of Higher Education himself. And so we insisted that the law must be respected. Universities must conduct their admissions without interference. The government was not willing to resolve these problems, so they turned around and arrested us. The lawyers had the same problem. The lawyers, our legal system had gradually been eroded until we were now having French-speaking judges who were trained in the civil law system to administer common law. And it brought a lot of corruption. It brought a lot of unfortunate imprisonments and poor judgments. And so our people, our lawyers insisted that there must be a redress of the wrongs. And as usual, the government started with the repression and arrests. So we decided to put our people together and formed what we called the Consortium of Civil Society Organizations, which brought together all unions. And I was the Secretary General of the consortium, because we realized that if we did not come together and bind in a consortium, the government was going to use divide and rule tactics, which was their strategy for 60 years, and fragment our quests and eventually bring us back to the starting point. And so that is how the civil society protest triggered off what has become a war today. Our people protested peacefully, but government decided to come in, the government of Cameroon decided to come in with violence. They used the army, they started killing to frighten people. It did not work. Then they started burning villages. They killed old people, killed the young, they killed women, and it has become a cycle.
The nature of the protest was, in essence, you know, shutting down the schools, and I imagine there were also mobilization protests, you know, et cetera. And then the government responded violently, and specifically arrested the number of the leaders of the protest. Is that correct?
Yes, I was arrested. I was arrested on the 17th of January, 2 days after we had just had a meeting with the government. We had agreed on a number of things. We asked the government to sign an agreement with us to say that, yes, we have agreed on these issues. Our schools will run themselves. We will, that there will be no more interference into the English system, English educational system. There will be no this. We will follow the spirit of the law as it is written. We all agreed on those things, but the government refused to let us append our signature on the document. And we knew that if we did not append our signature on the document, the government would change the document later. Because even during the discussions, every time that we agreed on a point, we insisted that we reread the document from the beginning so that we can recall everything that we have agreed on. But the government kept changing. Every time we reread a document, we realized that the government had changed some clauses. And so at the end of the day, we told them that we could not suspend our strike if we were not given room to sign the document and have a copy, because we needed it legally to back us and to justify to our constituency that on the basis of this agreement, we have now agreed that we will suspend our industrial action and give room for the government to begin implementation. But without that signature, we couldn't do it. So we told the government that if you don't want us to sign, then give us time to talk to our people that you don't want us to sign the document and let them decide whether we can suspend our strike or not. And they turned around and arrested us two, three days later. My car was burnt, and we understand that it was the work of the government, because where I had parked my car before going to the meeting, it was on the campus of the University of Boya. But it was done in such a way that the car was burnt, but the house next to which it was parked did not catch fire. So that is how the government started, and they started with a series of mass arrests. They arrested anyone who dared to talk about the conflict or who even texted a message. If they checked your phone and saw that you had any messages in your phone related to the protest, then you were going to be arrested. And the government's continuous use of force and the desire to enforce an arrest system whereby people had to bail themselves out caused the people to now look for means to defend themselves. Because the government came, for instance, they will come to your house, knock on your door, and if your 12, 13, 14-year-old son came to the door, they would arrest him and tell you to bring about $500. If you don't pay $500 by 3 o'clock in the afternoon, we are taking him to Yaoundé. And that is how a series of mass deportations began. And they started deporting children, young men and women from the English-speaking Southern Cameroons to the French-speaking Yaoundé. And that is how we have two prisons that are full of English-speaking Southern Cameroonians. And it has become a humanitarian problem.
And then in the Southern Cameroons, among the Anglophones, the decision then was made to shift from more nonviolent protests to more violent resistance and the Declaration of Independence in the region. How much has that complicated the potential for a resolution of this conflict?
The first thing I would like to say is that the government of Cameroon does not negotiate. They don't negotiate. If the government of Cameroon is talking to you, it is either you're going to give them money or you are in a position of weakness that will permit them to arrest you. And if they cannot arrest you, they are not going to talk with you. And if you're not going to give them money, then they are not going to talk with you. Or if you do not have the power to influence their getting money, then they don't have any business with you. Now, what happened was that the government of Cameroon, French Cameroon, decided, it's all started from corruption. The soldiers, those who were handling the conflict, started collecting money from the government because they needed mission allowances. This is a problem that could have been settled peacefully, and we were all disposed to a peaceful settlement. But some of the people in government underestimated the nature of the conflict and failed to realize that Southern Cameroonians had crossed a certain threshold of tolerance and patience. because for all these years, they had been treated like underdogs, slaves, and given all kind of ridiculous names within the country. If somebody duped you, they would say that if anybody who was duped was treated as an English-speaking Cameroonian, they say, you think I'm an English, that's why you're duping me. So it means that they had successfully manipulated their way and considered us as fools. And there were even times that we were described as the enemy in the house. We were described as Trojan horses. So they even called us Biafrans and made it in such a way. We were called Biafrans. And the government has never for once apologized for all these ridiculous treatments. And at one point, we even realized that they had systematically avoided teaching their children the history of the country so that French Cameroonian children grew up knowing that we, the English-speaking Cameroonians, came to Cameroon because there was war in Nigeria. And Cameroon gave us land. And now we have come in and we want to take over their country. And that's why whenever we had a protest, whenever Southern Cameroonians or English-speaking Cameroonians protested at any time, they were told to go back to their country, go back to your country. Why did you come here? So you can imagine living under those conditions for all those years. Some of our parents went through that humiliation and died miserably. So when we sat down and looked at what was going on, we were bound to protest at some point. Now, what escalated the conflict was the military violence. Too many innocent people were being killed and too many innocent young men were being arrested. And at some point, coupled with the poverty, the people had to reach for what they had to defend themselves. When the government started killing them, they reached for Dane guns. Dane guns are naturally local guns which use gunpowder. They use gunpowder and they are used for traditional ceremonies. So actually, they are not lethal weapons. So you use them for the ceremony because what matters is the noise that it produces. But eventually, as the government became ferocious in its attacks and started their scorched earth policy, burning down villages, the young men had to reach for their grandparents' ceremonial guns. And that is how the resistance began.
You were arrested, you were imprisoned, and you're currently in exile from your home. Has this resistance and the role that you've played, has it been worth it? Have you seen potential for real change as a result of the sacrifices you've made?
Yes, there is a potential for change. There is a potential for change, and especially with the new role that I'm playing now. I've played several roles. I have tried to put together some of the leaders of organizations in the liberation movement to see how they can work collectively to be able to achieve a common goal, because unity of purpose is essential to causes like ours. I have also worked in the humanitarian domain to give collecting support, clothes, medicine, financial assistance, and sending it to refugees who are in Nigeria or internally displaced persons, prisoners in dungeons in Yaoundé and in Douala and other parts of the country. So I have been making my own contribution, and currently I am the Secretary General of the Southern Cameroons Alliance, which brings together experts, professionals, politicians, civil society people, and all those who are willing to put aside their personal differences to work together for a common cause. We are working with international stakeholders to ensure that the people of Southern Cameroons have the opportunity to express themselves and choose how they want to live as the United Nations defines self-determination. So because we cannot, if we must resolve this problem, we must go to the root of the matter. And We are totally committed to talking, having dialogue with the government of Cameroon, but unfortunately they have not indicated. But since 2019, our people have been clamoring for dialogue because no matter what happens, we are still going to be either neighbors or something else depending on what the outcome will be. But the people should be able to determine how they want to live in their country, whether they want to live as slaves or they want to live as free people. So essentially, the Southern Cameroons Alliance is working to obtain truth, justice, and freedom for the people of Southern Cameroons. And the effort that I have put in so far, I am very optimistic that even if the world does not actually really understand what is going on, they will come to understand and realize that the plight of the people is worth giving attention to, and the solution will come.
And hopefully your testimony and today's show will at least elevate the visibility of this conflict that sadly many in the United States know terribly little about. So thank you very much for joining us. We've been discussing the ongoing crisis and civil war in Cameroon, in particular in Southern Cameroons. Our guest has been Dr. Fantem E. Neba. He was Secretary General of the Teachers Trade Union of the University of Bouea before his arrest on the 17th of January, 2017. He was the Secretary General of the now banned Cameroon Anglophone Civil Society Consortium. And now he is in exile and serves as the Secretary General of the Southern Cameroons Alliance. He was also a professor of applied linguistics at the University of Bouea, Cameroon. A special note, today's show has given us voices from Cameroon. And in particular, I'd like to thank Debbie McCormick and her tireless work in publicizing this crisis and her invaluable assistance in helping to organize today's panels.
Thank you to our guests and to you for listening. The Scholar's Circle team includes Doug Becker and Lillian Ng, contributing hosts, Ankine Agassian and Melissa Chiprin, managing producers, Sud Dongre, our webmaster, Tim Page and Mike Hurst, engineers and technical support. I'm Maria Armudian, and we'll see you next week.